Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, many of the websites you visit tell you they're using cookies. Sometimes they ask you to accept them. Sometimes they don't. They have many purposes, including remembering what you put in your virtual carts when online shopping. Beth Wendt back with us today. She's a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She brings 20 years of experience and a love for creative problem solving. And we're going to understand more about cookies, what they are, why sites use them, and of course, we'll take your questions as well. Do you have a question about ads or ad blockers or cookies? Are you having problems with your computer, your printer, or other technology? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Beth Wendt, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Larry. How are you? Good to be back.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I hope you are as well. You know, let's just start with the very basics here. What are cookies?
Well, unfortunately, they're not a delicious treat that your computer is going to deliver to you. As much as the name, you know, is kind of tricky, cookies basically are packets of information. So they're things that are used out on the internet. So you go to a website, and you interact with that website in some way. Either you enter in information to log into it, or you put items into a shopping cart, or you click on specific buttons in a certain order, or you go to certain pages in a certain order. Cookies are what that website uses to track your activity and that information that you're using to interact with that website. So in ways, it makes the experience of using that website a lot easier for the end user because it's going to remember information about you and it's going to help tailor the experience to you personally. But it is also storing information about your habits and then also information that you input into that website. So we do have to be kind of careful with those.
Where are those cookies stored? And do they take up space on our computer?
They do, actually. Yeah, they're stored locally on your machine. There's usually a cookies folder somewhere on your computer. Depending on which operating system you use, it'll be located in a different area. And also, depending on which web browser you're using to interact with the internet, the cookies are going to be stored in different places. But just about every web browser that I know of has a way for you to go in and clear out cookies, either manually or you can schedule that to happen at whatever frequency you like. Generally, in the settings of the web browser that you're using, you can go in and set up how you want your web browser to interact using cookies.
So the question is, why would a website want to track your visit? You've talked a little about this, but so they can send us a lot of ads.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's a big part of the reason. You know, they kind of sell it to the user as we're going to tailor your experience so that you're getting a personalized interaction with this website. But what they're really doing is tracking your habits so that they can feed you the information that they want you to see in order to target you for specific advertising. So that's really one of the main reasons why companies utilize cookies on their website is for tracking your behavior. Often they can sell information about that behavior to advertising organizations, so companies that do targeted advertising, or they can use it themselves to target you with ads using specific programs that they're set up with.
So how should a person decide if they should accept cookies?
Well, it really depends on the website that you are interacting with. If it's a reputable company that you don't mind getting targeted advertising from, then I would say go ahead and use don't disable the cookies and use it so that you get that targeted experience. If you don't want to see cookies, if you don't want any particular site to track your behavior, if you don't want any of that information that you input into the internet to be stored locally on your machine or on the provider's side, The best thing you can do is to use what's called an incognito window for browsing, which is a private browsing mode. And it's called different things depending on which web browser you're using. If you use Firefox, I believe it's called incognito mode. And if you use Chrome, it's called private browsing. But what you're doing is basically opening a window, a new window to the internet that is not allowing those sites to collect that information. It's not doing that acceptance of cookies.
And some websites do automatically track our cookies even without asking, right?
Well, there's been some new laws passed recently that require any website that is going to be used by anyone in the European Union, which I would think is pretty much any website out there, is required to at least inform the user at the first time they access that website that that site uses cookies and to give them the opportunity to accept or deny those cookies. So there was a set of laws, the acronym for it is GDPR, I believe, that was passed in 2018 that does require that to happen. Now, those are European laws, but because the internet is really not geographically specific, it's pretty much any website you go to now is going to ask you that.
Can they have an impact on and they certainly do have an impact on the type of advertising that we get? What's the sort of the details behind how they do that?
So if take Google, for instance, because that's a website that probably anyone who's ever used the internet is familiar with. And we all use Google to search for any particular information we want to look for. So let's say I am looking for a new pair of shoes. I would like a specific brand of shoe. And I go out to Google and I do a Google search on that brand plus the term clearance or sale. And I want to find out what online retailers have that brand of shoe on clearance sale right now. Google is going to make note of the fact that I Googled that shoe brand and clearance. And it's going to take that information and it's going to feed that into an algorithm that then when I go to, say, Facebook or Instagram or any of the, you know, kind of regularly frequented social media sites, I'm then going to see ads for that shoe company. It's going to feed me those ads with that brand. So it's kind of reinforcing that initial behavior that I had started by Googling it. And there's a whole stream of sales that goes on behind the scenes of Google capturing that information, selling that to then targeted ad reselling companies, and then them selling that ad space to those brands that want to use that targeted ad space. So there's a whole kind of back end market that happens based on my information and my habits.
Yeah, it's kind of irritating sometimes when you, all right, you go to a site, you actually buy a pair of shoes, let's say. All right, I bought the shoes and now I'm continuing to get a whole bunch of ads popping up telling me to buy the shoes.
I know that's pretty frustrating. I've had that same thought when I, you know, I go and look for what I want and then I buy it. And then suddenly for the next week, I'm seeing ads for what I just bought. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But of course, if you would just go and Google something else, you know, your ads would change pretty quickly to meet whatever the next thing you were looking for was.
Well, can cookies impact our likelihood of getting something like a virus?
Not necessarily delivering a virus to you, but they can be a source of information that some sort of malicious software could use in order to, do some sort of identity theft or some sort of data theft from you. So let's say you're storing cookies on your local computer and the website that you were using isn't using a secure form of cookies. And it's storing your authentication data for that website in plain text in that cookie. If somebody were to hack into your computer, they can get into your cookies file. If they see that username and password in plain text, now they have your credential information for that site, which could also be, you know, credential information you're reusing in other sites. So it is an information source that could potentially lead to some malicious activity happening, and is always a good idea if you're conscious of that. If you want to be kind of hyper vigilant, it is a good idea to go out and clear those cookies that your web browser has stored, you know, on a regular basis.
So just for the sake of finding out where to clear, let's take a Mac. Got a Mac and you want to clear the cookies. Where would you go?
All right. So if you're on a Mac, now, of course, you had to ask me about a Mac because I'm not on a Mac. I'm on a PC. But I'll walk you through as best I can. So I use Google Chrome. That's my preferred browser. And you can probably hear me in the background clicking through on my Google Chrome. There's usually either a little icon that looks like a gear, like a spoke or a gear, or there's an ellipsis icon, you know, the three dots. One of those two things is generally going to lead you to a settings menu. So I'm clicking on the ellipsis on mine and then going to settings. So as I look through Google Chrome, there's a whole bunch of settings on here that I can play around with to kind of set them up the way that I would like to browse the internet. And under the privacy and security settings, there is a clear browsing data section. And within clear browsing data, we've got several options. You can clear your browsing history. So that's the actual browser itself storing the history of websites that you've gone to. You can have it clear your cookies and other site data. That's what we're talking about is clearing out those cookies. And then there's also cached images and files, which would be anything that's stored locally from a website, like an image or some sort of data file. You can go in and clear that data yourself by just clicking on the clear data button. Or if you go to the advanced section, there are other settings that you can play around with to do that on a frequent basis if you want it to happen automatically.
All right. There we go. Beth Wendt, our guest today. Let's take some calls. Stephanie and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Stephanie.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about Wi-Fi. I'm on the third floor, and I'm sharing Wi-Fi with my neighbor who's on the first, and the signal, you can imagine, is kind of awful. And I heard that I can use an old modem to boost that signal. Now, the modem that has, or I can use a router to boost the signal. Now, my neighbor has the modem in their apartment, two floors below mine. I've looked up a lot of resources on how to make a router boost a signal, and none of them make sense.
Okay. Beth, what do you think?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, Stephanie. So, you know, it stands to reason that if you had something in between where the modem is and where you are that was making, you know, was bouncing that signal towards you, that it would kind of cover some of the distance. But generally using a router the modem itself is sending a Wi-Fi signal out if it's a Wi-Fi router modem, you know, that they're using for connection. But if that signal isn't strong enough to get up to the third floor to you, generally putting a router with a dual band wireless antenna built into it is going to boost that signal for you rather than using some router in between. It's kind of always better to have the source of that signal be kind of the strongest source of it rather than trying to push it out through another device as well, and actually trying to bridge those two devices together to get that signal boosted is probably going to be pretty convoluted if they're not the same brand or have the same signal frequency that they're using. So if you're sharing with your neighbors, you may want to work with your neighbors, pitch in, buy an upgraded modem / router that has a dual band Wi-Fi antenna, and to use the higher frequency on that dual band, that'll give the signal a little bit more distance. So instead of using the router in between, that's probably the route I would go.
All right, Stephanie, I hope that helps. That help?
Thanks. I appreciate it. It does.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Beth Wendt, she is a senior IT specialist at the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. You can join in with your tech questions as well. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Beth Wendt, IT specialist, senior IT specialist at the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. We get you on pretty quickly. Mike from Bruce, Wisconsin, has a question, Beth, about battery life on his and his wife's iPhones. They both have 6Ss. He says their battery life seems really limited, and when one of their kids checked it, and they both report that the battery life is 89%. He's wondering what that means, especially if when they charge them, they say 100%. The son did power down a few things, thinking that might help, but our batteries run down quite fast. When cold outside, they go down really fast. Do they need new batteries, new phones? What suggestions do you have? With the pandemic, they're not wild about going out and shopping for new phones.
This is a question that I've answered for many family members of mine who, you know, over the years with their various cell phones have had a similar issue. And I've all seen it myself with my own, iPhones, various iPhones over the years. And something I've read up on a bit is dead spots in the types of batteries that are used in cell phones. They can develop what's called dead spots. And that generally happens when the phone itself is plugged in to a charger beyond the point of 100% battery charging. So once the battery is charged up to 100%, if the battery is then still plugged in to the charger, that additional electrical current going through the battery can eventually start to create dead spots in that battery. Those spots will no longer hold a charge. So the capacity of the battery itself becomes diminished. So when you're seeing that 89% battery life reported in the battery settings of the iPhone, that's basically saying you only have 89% of this battery available to you in order to charge up to 100%. So the battery's capacity is diminished, which means seeing 100% is only 100% of what's available in that
battery. 89%.
Yeah, exactly. So, my suggestion, and this is easier said than done, because generally we plug in our phones before we go to sleep. We go to bed, we wake up in the morning, it's been charged up to 100% for the last 4 hours, and we were asleep, so we didn't think to unplug it. I don't know if there are any updates yet for the operating system that automatically stop that charging at a certain point so that there's no more electrical current running to the battery after that 100% charging. But that's certainly something that I would think the manufacturers of cell phones would potentially be looking into. Although, if you think of it from the business side of things, it's not in their interest to give you long-lasting hardware. They want you to upgrade your hardware every few years. So the reason why they don't make tires out of rubber that goes all the way through and you have to fill them up with air is because if they were solid rubber, they would never wear out.
Okay. Wow. Oh, man. Well, it is irritating to lose the phone. And as you say, when you go to bed, you plug it in and you're not going to wake up in the middle of the night to unplug. That's for sure. But that's a great explanation. Thanks for that, Beth. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Richard in West Salem, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am interested in installing a security system. I'm interested in checking up on the safety of my mom in her own home. Recently, one of the websites had one on sale, and I bought it today. But I don't know anything about it. I don't need to store images. I just need to be able to check whenever I want to on my phone. Do you know anything about that, or what would I need to find out? What do I need to look for?
you're basically just looking for a live view into a space without having to record any video on anything. And if that's the case, there are a whole bunch of like home-based products that are out there right now. I know more about like the doorbell-based system, so like the Ring doorbells, which those record on motion, or you can set them up to continuously record. But I know that most of the products that are out there, they've got several different ways that you can set them up. So you can, like I said, they've got this continuous recording. If you always want the images that are on that camera recorded, they've got record on motion, which means that nothing would be recorded unless there was motion in front of the camera. And then they've got like live view only, which sounds like what you're looking for, where there's nothing actually recorded by the camera. But if you ever want to check in on what's going on, that you can set it up so that you can get a live glimpse into the room where the camera is located. And I would think that the manufacturer of the product that you purchased within their documentation will have information on how to set up those various recording settings.
Yeah, and live view only, I think you hit it the nail on the head there. That's what you need to kind of look for in the manufacturer's directions, Richard. Thank you for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Well, Mary in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a frustrating problem with my Yahoo Mail. I've used it for years, and then the other day I pulled it up like usual, and it said I had to sign in. And so I tried to sign in. I had to re-put in. I had it so that it would go directly there, but I had to re-put in my name, username, and password, and it wouldn't accept it. So I put in forgot password, so I went to that, and they said, well, that's not working right now. We can't connect you to that. Try back later. Well, I've done this for several days, and I just can't get in there. So anyway, I took it to Best Buy. They couldn't do anything about it. Said to call or go online to Yahoo, and of course you got to pay if you're gonna ask them a question. So I tried calling them, and the number doesn't work. So I just can't get any help for this, and I've got all my emails in there, and I can't get to it. I do have them on my iPad. It's the desktop that I can't get them on. So is there anything I can do or some place to go or someone to call or get help with that?
Okay. Beth, what do you think?
Okay, well, so one thing you said that's really good, you can still get that account on your iPad. It's just on the desktop that you're not able to access it. Likely what you'll need to do is to go through on the iPad and go through Yahoo's reset password process. So since you're able to access it on your iPad I would log in on the iPad like you normally do to your mail and go through the, I'm trying to remember what Yahoo Mail looks like. I haven't been in it for a long time, but there should be an option for support where you can do a reset password and they can send you a link to your email, which you can still access on your iPad that will take you to a website to reset your password, which will then allow you to, on your desktop, put the new password in so that you can access it on both devices.
Okay, so it involves you need to change the password off the iPad.
It sounds to me like there's some mismatch between passwords on the iPad and on the desktop. So if you go in on the iPad and go through the reset password process, and then go to the desktop and put that new password in, you should be able to access it then on both devices.
Oh, sure. Why not? Mary, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jay in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Good morning to you. I've got a question about cookies and blocked email. If I eliminate the cookies occasionally, as you suggested, will that require me to re-enter information on websites that I purchase products from? And In my email, I run up against a limit of blocked emails that I can enter. And once that is full, it gives me an error signal. And I have to enter my unblock or remove the blocked emails. And then, of course, well, they're not blocked. So I'm wondering about the limit of blocked emails that I've got and how stored information is affected by erasing the cookies.
Okay.
All right, good questions. So on the cookies question, if you were to deny cookies for a specific site, let's say you go to a site and it asks you if you want to accept or deny cookies, you say deny. Any information that you put into that site at that point is not going to be stored for the next time you visit that same site. So if you say log into that site and check the box that says keep me logged in, it's not going to keep you logged in. So the next time you go back to that website, you're going to have to re-authenticate. So you'll have to put in your username and password to do that again. I think that's a good idea because it's a good security practice to not have websites remember your login information. But also if you are, if you have certain preferences within that website, let's say you were shopping on Amazon and you weren't using cookies, you put a bunch of stuff in your cart and then walked away to go make yourself some lunch, closed out your browser, come back, go to Amazon again. Amazon's not going to remember what you put in your cart. If you have like a name and address information that needs to be filled in on a site, that won't be remembered for the next time you have to go in and put in that information. So it's really, the website's going to think it's seeing you for the first time every time it sees you if you don't use cookies. And then as far as your blocked email settings question, I do have a follow-up just to tailor this a little bit. Can you tell me what email client you're using to check your messages?
Yes, it's Charter Spectrum.
Are you using the web browser to go to Charter's webmail, or are you using something like Microsoft Outlook?
I'm assuming it's my Google web browser that I originally got the information from.
So when you want to check your email, you log in through a web browser to check your email?
Well, I've got it on the desktop.
What's the application on your desktop that you use?
I'm ignorant about computeries.
Okay.
So are you talking about my internet browser?
Is that what you use when you want to check your email? Is the first thing you do to open your web browser?
No. Yes. At this point, now I do. I have to access Google now. Something has changed, but yes.
No problem. It really depends on what email application you're using, how many addresses you're able to put in to block. So certain applications have limits on the number of addresses you're allowed to block within your personal account. And it has a lot to do with the way mail is processed. I'm not going to go into that because that can get real technical. But the more blocked senders you have, the more likely it is that something that isn't supposed to get rejected from your email will be. So in order to avoid that, a lot of email providers will put limits on the number of addresses you can block incoming messages from, which is likely why you're getting that error message telling you that you've reached that limit.
Fortunately, I continue to get a lot of new spam. Maybe I'm going to just have to mark them spam, have them sent to the spam folder instead of the blocked mail folder.
Yeah, in fact, when you mark something as spam and send it to your spam folder, it actually notifies your email provider that that is a spam sender, and your email provider can then block that incoming message instead of you having to do it on your side. So I would recommend, rather than blocking the sender, I would recommend marking it as spam because that notifies Charter that that's a spammer.
There you go. That's a great suggestion. Thank you, Jay, for calling. I appreciate it. John in Mequon, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning, Larry and guest. All this talk about cookies is getting me hungry right before lunchtime, but I'll proceed anyway. I recently put in a Ring doorbell, and the Ring device is telling me I don't have a strong enough signal to take advantage of their recordings and other characteristics of that security device. And my Charter modem and end router is upstairs in the bedroom, which is right down, just right upstairs from the front door. And Charter is telling me, or Spectrum is telling me, that they cannot increase the signal at all. Do this kind of dovetails on your other signal question. Do I get a stronger router perhaps by myself? Do I get a range extender that I can put into, plug into the wall? What would you recommend so I can get a strong signal sent to that Ring doorbell?
Yeah, great question. So my recommendation for where your router and your Wi-Fi router in your house goes is generally to put it on the lowest floor of your home, if possible. Those Wi-Fi signals, when they come up out of the antenna, kind of direct upward. So if you are trying to cover your home, probably the best place for that Wi-Fi router is kind of right in the middle of your house at the lowest point, in the lowest floor. So it's going to really encompass that whole area. So you're sending your signals from above your doorbell, and those signals are kind of traveling in an upward direction to start, which means the strongest signal isn't heading downward towards where that doorbell is trying to access it. Putting in a range extender, those can be helpful. That's more to get your signal to go further, and it may be that you're not getting enough. It's not that your signal isn't going far enough, but it's not strong enough at that spot. So I would more likely recommend, like I said with the earlier caller, a dual band Wi-Fi router modem that has a much stronger signal coming out of the antenna, or moving your Wi-Fi router to a lower floor on your house.
Yeah, I have mine in the basement, and mine works great. So, John, I hope that helps.
Yes.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mary in Greendale, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mary.
Hey, thank you. I'm calling because I've recently gotten a new Acer computer, and yesterday we did our first Google Zoom call. And we could not hear the people on the Zoom call, even though we had the volume to the highest level on the computer. Is there something else that we have to do to get the volume up?
Well, it depends on the speakers that are in the computer, especially if it's a laptop. Generally, the onboard speakers on those are pretty terrible. Definitely recommend, if you want better sound coming out of your computer, to not use the onboard speakers, but to obtain a pair of external speakers that plug into it, or a headset. Generally, you're going to get pretty terrible sound out of the stock speakers that come in a new machine like that. If the volume itself works well, say when you're, watching a show on Netflix, but doesn't work well when you're doing a Zoom call, then it may not be the speakers that are a problem, but there may be some sound settings within Zoom that you would need to adjust. And within Zoom, if you go into the settings on the top menu, I know that there's an audio settings menu within there that you can play around with, how the sound comes out of your machine when you're on a Zoom call. So I would try to play with those settings within Zoom first test out listening to something else outside of Zoom. So play some music or, you know, turn on Netflix and see if the sound comes out okay that way. If the sound is better there than it is in Zoom, you may need to change those settings. If the sound is no good in any application you're using on the machine, I'd recommend then getting some external speakers that you can just plug in to the machine to get better sound from it.
Yeah, but start with those settings in Zoom. I know other people have had that kind of issue as well, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Pauline emailed with a question. She says some of her are Wisconsin communities that post committee meeting agendas and minutes require Flash Player to be installed in order to read the documents. In the past, she's heard that Flash Player isn't safe to use and could possibly contain malware. Is it now safe to install a program when it prompts her to click on the link to install the program?
Yeah, I know that there were some concerns about Flash Player in earlier versions, and there was also some controversy between Adobe, which is the manufacturer of Flash Player, and Apple. So they were not allowing Flash Player to be installed on any Apple product. So you couldn't view anything on Flash Player on an iPhone or an iPad or any of the Apple products. But that was more of a dispute between corporations rather than a security issue. Now Flash is pretty secure. As far as reviewing meeting minutes, it seems a little strange to me that they would require something like Flash Player to view that.
Yeah.
I would recommend, you know, anybody who's producing meeting minutes to push those out via PDF file using Adobe Acrobat. That's about as safe as you can get. So if they have another way to view those files and it's through Adobe Acrobat, a PDF file, that would be my recommendation.
Yeah. You mentioned iPhone, and we had a caller who couldn't stay online who said the newer iPhones, this has to do with batteries, the newer iPhones actually do have a feature that tells you what time the phone will be done charging and will automatically stop charging once the battery is full. So that's built right into the iPhones, the newer ones.
Oh, it sounds like I need to get a new iPhone then.
I've got a 6S myself, and I've been thinking about getting a newer one just for a variety of reasons, frankly. Well, Deb in Mount Horeb, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling about, I have an iPhone, and I'm getting unwanted notifications and a lot more recently because of the election, but I do get other unwanted ones. Is there some way to stop those?
Yeah, absolutely. I get annoyed by those things all the time. So if you go in to the settings on your iPhone, there's a settings application. Click on the settings. Right on that first screen, there's a notifications tab. And if you click on notifications, basically it gives you, for every single app that you've got installed on your iPhone, you can choose how you want it to notify you or if you don't want it to notify you at all. So you can turn these on and off to a very granular level, and you can even tailor how you want it to notify you. So if, say I want only phone calls to give me notifications and nothing else. I turn off all the notifications for everything else. I leave them on for phone calls. And let's say for phone calls, I only want it to show me a message on my lock screen telling me that I've got a missed call. I can configure the notification to that level of granularity if I want to. So I would suggest going in there and turning off anything you don't want to see.
There you go, Deb. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Beth Wendt, our guest today, she's worked in IT for nearly 20 years, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your computer, your phone, and all kinds of technology today with our guest, Beth Wendt. of the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So questions for her. Do you have questions about ads or cookies? What tech problems are you having? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Steve emailed with a question. He says his antivirus software has a quick clean process, and he is has it set to remove the cookies. It's supposed to clean the cookies every night because it runs at 9 p.m. How well does it do it? How can he check? Any ideas there, Beth?
Yeah, you can actually look directly in the cookies folder to see if those files have disappeared. So probably the easiest way to do that is to just go into the search menu on your computer. If you're on a Mac, you know, you just go search at the top folder level. Or on a PC, if you just click on the start menu and start typing in your search field to search for cookies. And it will bring up a list of where all the cookies are stored on your machine. And what you can do is just go in and check up in that folder in the morning. If there's no files in it, then you can see that those cookies have been cleared out. Go to a bunch of websites. You'll see that directory fill up with files. And then as your quick clean runs, you can see that those files will then be deleted at the end of the day. So you can check up on it to see if it's, you know, make sure it's working.
Very cool. John called with a suggestion for the earlier caller with the doorbell problem. I thought your suggestion was great. He said it might not be an internet connection problem. He said it could be a power supply to the doorbell. They may have to update the transformer to a 16 volt. He said older homes often have lower voltage transformers. And that's probably another thing to consider, too, and to look at.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the power as being an issue, but that's, you know, another likely suspect.
Yeah, especially if it's an older home. Kay in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Okay, I have just a kind of a, it's a couple of questions. One of them is I tried to get email on my smartphone. I do not have a computer, internet, or anything here, but I use my phone and I can get it. And I tried to get email, and it told me in order to get it and sign up, I had to go to Google Play Store. And I did that, and all I got, it completely changed the whole operation of my phone. I kept getting all these games to buy these games, and it was just like, everything was different, and I was frustrated because I just learned how to run this phone anyway after having it for a couple years, and I had that happen, and I would like to have email, but do I have to go through Google Play Store?
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you were, what kind of, I guess, what email provider you were looking to go through to use email. If you have one that you already use that you were trying to download an application that you need in order to access that email provider, then you would need to go through whatever app store your phone supports, which sounds like it's a phone that uses Google Play for delivering applications to it. But if it's new email that you're looking for, you certainly don't need to go through Google Play to download an application to access a new email address. If I would recommend signing up for Gmail through not through Google Play, but just going to gmail.com and signing up for an account, that you can access just right through the web browser on your phone. And you won't need to download any application in order to do that. So you won't need to actually put anything on the phone in order to access your email that way.
And then you'll just have to go back and get a hold of your friends or whoever you want the email with to give them your email address, I would assume, Beth.
Yep.
Okay, that's the easy way out. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, and email us at ideas@wpr.org. We had another email about Wi-Fi problems from a listener. They said they live in a big house with a total of 6 people who all use phones and stream. They have they only have satellite internet, and the house is so big they have a couple of relay signal boosters. But the internet is painfully slow, and most streaming services won't work due to buffering. Oh, man. Any suggestions?
Yeah, so the satellite internet is notoriously slow at this point. So the signal that you're getting coming to your home is where the bottleneck is. It's adding a signal booster to make the signal, you know, go further within your house or be stronger at longer, you know, at longer distances isn't going to help when the signal coming to your house is already pretty small. So the amount of internet bandwidth that you need in order to stream video is generally about 6 megabits. And with those satellite services, you're kind of often lucky if you can get up to that point to be able to stream video successfully without the buffering issues. And right now in a lot of rural communities, there isn't another answer other than that satellite internet. There is, however, a new satellite internet that's going to be offered, supposed to be at the beginning of 2021 through the Starlink, which is a company affiliated with SpaceX. Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, also owns SpaceX, which is putting hundreds of satellites up currently in order to create a worldwide net of satellite internet with much higher signal speeds at lower prices. So I would take a look at Starlink, read up on it, see when it's going to be available in your area, and that might be something you want to budget for in the future to get yourself a much better internet signal coming to your house.
Yeah, that makes good sense. That would that will be a very popular item once it's up and running. I'm pretty sure of that. Well, AJ in Columbus, Wisconsin, it's your turn now. Hi, AJ. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So I have an iPhone, and when I do video record, so even if it's just 15 seconds or 20 seconds, and then I want to email it to my Gmail account, it tells me that the file, sorry, to my Yahoo account, it tells me that the file is too large. So I would like to know, how do I reduce it so that I'd be able to email it to myself on my Yahoo account?
Yeah, so most email providers have a limit on the size of files that you can email through them. So likely that video is just too large to be sent by your email provider. But there are many other ways that you can actually share that video without actually having to send the whole video. My recommendation, and this is what I do in order to effectively share photos and videos, I use Google Photo. So basically what I've done, I signed up for a Gmail account that automatically enables me to use Google Photo. I've downloaded the Google Photo app onto my iPhone, and whenever I take a picture or create a video, I have the option to then save it into my Google Photo Drive, which then uploads it to the cloud, stores it in the cloud. There isn't a file size limit on those, so it will upload whatever I put in there. And if I want to share that video with someone, I actually send them a link to the video stored in the cloud rather than sending them the video. So when I want to send the link, I go into my Google Photo app, I choose the video or photo that I want to send, and when you click on the little send icon, it gives you the option to share a link. You can share the link, send that to someone via email, they click on the link, and it'll take them to where that video is stored in the cloud. So you're not actually sending the video anywhere. You're just sharing the location of it in your cloud storage.
AJ, does that help?
Yes, very much. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. More good advice there. Let's go to Maria in Milwaukee. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, my mother's computer got hacked, And a friend of mine said, okay, well, so then she shut it down. I said, close it off, Mom, don't use it. Okay, she did that. And then a friend of mine said, well, you have to wipe the computer. And I don't really know exactly what this entails. Is it hard? Is it something reasonably I could do?
So what they mean generally by wiping a computer is erasing everything on the hard drive of the computer and formatting it back to its original state before you owned it. So that's kind of the, it's called a format. So it just erases everything that's on the hard drive of the computer. Doing the actual erasing is very simple, but what you have left is a computer with a hard drive that has nothing on it. So you don't have an operating system, which means Windows or the Mac OS that was on there is gone. All the data that was on there, so any photos or files or anything that you had stored on that computer is now gone. So it's basically just erasing it to a blank slate, and you need to then reinstall everything back on it. That's the hard part, is the rebuild.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
Think about that a little bit more, Beth. And Maria, you can hang with us. And we're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back. And I know Beth has more for you, Maria, and for you, too, as you're listening in. I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your computer, your phone, all of your digital things with our guest today, Beth Wendt, Senior IT Specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Great to have her with us, and certainly questions. Lots of callers online, but the number is 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And Beth, you were, I sort of interrupted you as we broke for news there, but anything further you wanted to add to our caller's question?
I would recommend that before they do any kind of a reformat of their computer, that they make sure that they have the disk that they need for reinstalling the operating system on the computer. So it's usually called a recovery disk or an OS restore disk. Usually comes with your computer when you purchase it. If you don't have one of those, you're going to need a copy of Windows or Mac OS to reinstall on it from some other source. So I recommend making sure you have that first. And any data that you want off of the computer, save that onto a flash drive or something first. Otherwise, it's going to be all wiped out.
Yeah, I had to do that, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And what I did was I took it to the Division of Information Technology and had them do it so that it was done properly and I didn't lose all my data.
That's what we're there for.
Let's take another call. Ashley in New Zealand. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
I'm getting a lot of unsolicited emails, advertising emails, and on my Gmail, and I want to know how to stop them because I try to press the unsubscribe, almost unreadable thing at the bottom. But it never works. They continue to keep coming.
Yeah, there's a couple things you can do to get rid of those. So I know, especially because you're using Gmail, you can mark them as spam. And if you mark them as spam, that will report those to Gmail, and hopefully they will eventually put a block on that sender. But if it's not a spammy email, if it's just something you're signed up for by virtue of something you had put your email address into at one point in time. I use a service called Unroll Me, UNROLL.ME is the website. If you go to that website, you can put in your email address and it'll scan through basically known spammers or subscription sites, and it will remove you from their roles so that you'll stop getting those subscription spams from that company. So I use Unroll.me to keep myself off of those lists.
So it's UNROLL.me, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Ashley, does that help?
It did. Very good. Thank you.
All right.
And I can tell you it's raining in New Zealand tomorrow.
Okay. Well, it's raining in Madison as well, Ashley. So thank you so much for calling. Well, it's nice to hear from New Zealand. Karen is in Eagle River, a little closer to home. And Karen, hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
My computer recently began to display in the lower right corner in a gray box what look to be notifications but are really at the level of spam. I can delete them quite simply, but I'd like to stop them arriving at all. They sometimes come in sequences of up to 10 or 12.
Yeah, those are kind of annoying too. I get the same thing I see from the notes here you're using Windows 10. Is that correct, Karen?
Yes.
Okay. If you want to shut those off on Windows 10, down in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen, there's a little button that looks like a chat balloon. If you click on that, it brings up that gray menu on the side of your screen. At the very top of that window, there's a Manage Notifications link.
Uh-huh.
You click on that, you can go in and turn those notifications on or off for whatever application is doing the notifying.
Aha! There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Sharon in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, I need to get a new computer. It's been a long time since I bought a new computer. And so I'm starting over from scratch and trying to decide how best to determine what's going to work best for me. And if there are specific websites or anything that you would recommend that I consult to help me identify what might work best. I do a lot of spreadsheets. I can tell you that a lot of what I do is basically spreadsheets.
And you have email. Do you play games at all?
No, because I don't have internet access where I live, unfortunately. They can't seem to figure out how to install it here.
Oh, you're in Ashland. Okay.
I'm in the northern western tip of Ashland County, and there's just nothing here. So,
all right. Well, that may help a little bit, Beth. Any, at least in Beth giving you an answer, Beth, what do you think?
Well, as far as like figuring out what's best for you, so no internet, not playing games on it, mostly doing spreadsheets. You know, really, as long as you're not doing any kind of crazy video or photo editing or any like computer aided design or anything that requires like very heavy resource intensive applications, a pretty basic machine is going to work for you. So you're not going to need to spend a whole lot on something in order to get what you need just to really run spreadsheets or data processing type of software or something like Word or Excel. As far as recommendations for what to buy, if you have a local computer shop that you can stop into and talk to them about what your needs are, generally those folks are going to be able to point you in the right direction of what's a good purchase for you to make. And they may even have some models in the store that you can purchase from them. And if you're, you know, not real, computer comfortable and you want to have local support that you could take the machine into anytime to get fixed, usually those local shops are a good bet. But if you're just looking to buy something, you know, say off the internet, have it delivered to you, you don't really need to have a local support around for it. I've used Consumer Reports for information on, you know, what's out there within my price range and within my needs. They have some pretty good walk you through wizards that will help you figure out what your needs are. So if you go out to Consumer Reports website and go through their PC reviews, I believe they have a thing where you can kind of fill out what you're doing with a computer, and it'll lead you to, you know, kind of here's what you need as far as resources, and here are some brands and models that would meet that. So I would say Consumer Reports is still a really good resource for products like that.
Yeah, and probably think screen size, too.
Spreadsheets. Yeah, if you're looking at a laptop, you know, you want screen size, the size of the machine, the weight, if you're going to be moving around with it, you don't want a big, heavy one, you want something smaller. So a lot of different factors weigh in.
If I'm looking at those kinds of tables a lot, spreadsheets a lot, I kind of like bigger screens. At least my eyes tell me I need bigger screens. So that's definitely something not to forget about when you're looking, Sharon. Good luck. Thank you. Elliot in the UP of Michigan, your turn. Hi, Elliot.
Hello. Hi. Yes, I'm just calling to express some of my concerns about the internet and the world in general, about how our service, the internet, has basically been squandered by a few individuals starting around the year when Tesla's technology was basically bought out by J.P. Morgan. And my concern is we're now paying for something that was intended to be free service worldwide. And now a few technocrats, you could say, basically are selling it back to us. And I feel that's just a travesty in general.
Oh. Well, Elliot, thank you. A comment from you, Beth?
Yeah, I think Elliot is talking about the Wardenclyffe project out in upstate New York that Nikola Tesla set up back in the early 20th century to project power out to the masses wirelessly from a large tower that would give folks, I believe, AC power for free without wires. And that, you know, Tesla was bought out by J.P. Morgan, and I think in 1917 or something like that, and they did not want to give away free power. So I think any commodity resource in the world at some point, if we live in a capitalist environment, is going to be kind of taken over by capital in order to make money for somebody. And the internet has been treated the same way that power was back in the early 20th century, where a few large conglomerations have kind of bought up all the small providers and are selling us a resource that, you know, could be a public common good commodity that is of no charge. But yeah, that's kind of the way the world works.
Yeah. Elliot, thanks for your comment. Appreciate it. Lance in Guadalajara, Mexico, your turn. Hi, Lance.
Hi, thanks so much.
Sure thing. What's that? Yeah, go ahead.
I have a Android tablet that is really great. I love the way it works, but recently acquired some sort of malware. I think the term for it is a redirect, where any application I'm in, suddenly it shrinks and minimizes, and then my browser comes up with advertising pages, one or several. And I've been trying to read up on how to remove it. I've tried malware bytes, and it doesn't seem to catch it. And somebody said that there's a JavaScript template page or something, and I have to find that and remove that or reset it. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I don't know about the specific piece of malware that your tablet's infected with, so I wouldn't know how to remove it. But probably your best bet, especially because you're on a tablet, is to just reset it back to the factory default. If you go into the settings for the Android operating system, there should be an option to reset to factory default. If you do that, it will wipe all the data that's on the tablet out and reset you back to the original format that it came in the box. So with just the original applications that were on there without any of the malware that may have been installed afterwards.
And then you've got a little bit of work ahead of you.
You don't have to do the rebuild like you would on a PC or a Mac. Since it's a tablet, the operating system will be there. It's just none of the settings that you put in it after you bought it will be there. So there is some work, you know, as far as any applications you downloaded after the fact, you would have to re-download those or any information you had stored on there. But that'll wipe out any malware problem that you have on the machine pretty quickly.
All right. Lance, thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Jim in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon. I am on a monthly basis inviting people to an event. I serve on a local volunteer board. And when I look at the invite, it says that I'm the organizer and I'm sending it to about five people. I'm not sending it, and I'm not sure how I can stop doing this on a reoccurring basis. It looks like it's an invitation that was copied from the person who probably should be inviting people a while ago, and it just keeps reoccurring from me.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting. What program are you inviting people to a meeting in?
It's a Zoom.
A Zoom meeting? Okay.
Yes.
It's probably a recurring meeting that someone set up.
Yep.
And you said it's coming from you?
Yeah, when I look at the invitation that went out to five people, it shows me as the organizer.
Yeah, if you go into Zoom, generally, if there's a recurring meeting, it'll show up in the startup screen of Zoom, like join an existing meeting or start a new meeting is usually the screen that shows up. And any like recurring meetings that you have that have been set up under your name will show up in that recurring meeting list. You should be able to go in and delete that meeting from that recurring meeting list, and that should stop sending the invitation out.
Jim, that help?
So I'm going into the Zoom app to do that?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I will try that. I hope it works. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I can understand why I'd want to change that for sure. Thanks again, Jim. Well, Sharon and Ashlyn, we're on to you now. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I called a little bit ago, and something went wrong. I couldn't, you guys didn't seem to be hearing me, and I couldn't get you to hear me. So I'm going to try again.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm looking to get a new computer. I do a lot of spreadsheets. And I was looking for advice on looking for a new computer. And one of the suggestions that you had made was to go to my local computer store. Well, there really isn't one here. There's one little tiny store here. They don't have computers that you can try out there. You basically have to just agree to buy one. And then you figure out if it's going to work for you after you get it home. They will only order them. There's no way for you to look at anything. So I guess I need a little bit more guidance on computers that might meet my needs.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like, Sharon, that your needs are pretty minimal as far as resources that the computer has. So you're not going to need anything really upscale or fancy or expensive. After the recommendation of checking with a local computer store, the other thing I had mentioned was potentially checking with Consumer Reports online. They do have some guides that you can walk through where they ask you a series of questions about how you're going to use the computer. And that can lead you to then recommendations for what machine would be best to meet your needs.
But are you online, Sharon?
I don't have any way to get internet access.
They don't have any internet access. Yeah.
No, they haven't really gone through this area yet and installed a lot of stuff. I could get it if I was willing to pay them $20,000. They told me they would go ahead and trench it in for me as long as I paid $20,000. And
do you have internet on your cell phone?
And no, it's just a little inexpensive cell phone. It doesn't work very well for that sort of thing.
Well, if you do have an opportunity to to take a look at, I don't know, maybe at your local library. I'm not sure what their situation is with COVID, but Unfortunately, if you don't have any local resources, like a store that you could go to, or online resources that you can research, you know, don't have a lot of other options available for you.
Other than, you know, I guess print is still there. You know, there are still magazines out there that have that kind of information. Isn't there, Beth?
Yeah, well, and you can also call some of the, computer providers. So I generally buy Dell products, and that's just my preference because it's what I'm used to using, and I've been using them for years. And I find Dell to be a reputable company that makes pretty good machines. But if I didn't have a computer to look on Dell's website to see what they were offering for sale, I could call them and work with one of their sales reps. Now I'm talking to somebody who's trying to sell me a machine then, and they may not necessarily want to sell me the least machine. They're going to probably try to sell me the most machine that they can. So, you know, if you're going directly to a vendor to buy a product, they're not always going to sell you the least of what you need. So you may end up spending more money than you want to. So that's kind of the only caveat there.
But it's probably cheaper than $20,000.
Definitely. I would hope.
And again, you know, just to mention again, screen size, given the kinds of uses you have for it, Sharon, that's something you would want to explain to whoever you talk to. And maybe your eyes are better than mine and you don't care if you had a larger screen, but I definitely would want a larger screen. Does that help?
Somewhat.
You're giving us few options here.
I guess it's just been so long since I actually shot for a computer. I didn't know if certain brands just sort of had better reputation than others, or, you know, I had a Dell computer before and I loved it, and it broke my heart when it quit working.
Yeah.
But I've had Dell before, and I'm trying to think of the last company. I guess that would have been through my job, so I kind of forget what brand they had us using for those. I think we were using Microsoft, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, well, if you've been happy with Dell in the past, if you're looking for a laptop, I know their Inspiron line of laptops. That's kind of their home use line is really inexpensive, and, you know, you definitely won't be buying more than you need in that line. If you're looking for a desktop model, their Optiplex line is very good and would be, you know, what you need in order to do the spreadsheets you're looking for. So if Dell's the brand you're comfortable with, either one of those product lines would probably work really well for you.
All right. Well, good luck, Sharon. Very much appreciate your call. And Beth, appreciate you being with us as well. The time flew by. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us, and I hope to hear from you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Larry. Have a great rest of your day.
You as well. Beth Lynch, you'll be back, and she will be with us again to talk about your IT issues. Always like having her with us. She's an IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about living with hearing loss at 11, and then at 11:45, we'll hear about the Wisconsin Science Festival. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.